This morning we're going to look at how the Lord Jesus Christ takes this woman in John chapter 4 and describes for her what true worship is. What's one of the fascinating things to me about this passage is not just that we're dealing with worship, but woven into this passage is what we often call evangelism or outreach. The woman's a Samaritan. She's not connected to the Jewish covenant people. In fact, those two groups are at odds. And I recall thinking through things about missions, evangelism, worship when I was in college, and going on my first mission trip out of the country. I was probably a sophomore in college, I think, and my mentor at the church where I went to in college in Rome, Georgia, was going on a trip to Russia. So I went with him, and on the trip, I took John Piper's book, Let the Nations Be Glad. It was a phase in my life where I heard John Piper speak in Atlanta, and I thought, who is this guy? So I bought a couple of his books, and I thought, well, this will be good. I'll read this book on missions as I'm going on the mission field. One of the fascinating things about that book is he actually takes this passage. He takes this passage, it may have been a whole chapter he spent on it. And he focuses in on this section in verse 23 and 24, specifically 23, where he says, where Jesus says, true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. And I'll never forget what he said, because all my life I was raised in a church that said outreach was the main thing. How I got people saved was the main thing. And then it just stopped there. I mean, they came to church and did stuff, but I thought I was doing the main thing. And then learning that in that context, preaching was always about how much response you got. And so Piper said, notice what Jesus is saying here. What is the goal of what the Father's doing in verse 23? When true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. The goal is worship. It was life transforming. It was like, what? The goal of the passage is the Father is bringing people to worship him. The Father is bringing people to draw near to him. The Father is bringing people to him as we see in Revelation. So every tongue and language and tribe and all the peoples of the world may gather to honor and glorify him. That's the goal. The means to get there, the passage says, is the Father seeking such people. And Piper pointed out, the seeking of the Father is that outreach. The seeking of the Father is us going to serve the community, is us going out. That's not the goal, he said. The goal is worship. And I'll never forget, he went on in Atlanta when I heard him to go through that list of verses he used to do back at that time when he'd go around and speak and tie together all these verses about the glory of God. The glory of God in reaching people. The glory of God in you confessing your sin. The glory of God in growing in righteousness. All these things reflect back to the glory of God and the worship of God. And so the goal of the Father is to move people to worship him. And in worshiping him, what we're going to see in this passage is it's interwoven with this notion of drawing near to him and this living water that flows up from us, that comes to us by the Spirit and is supposed to flow out of us as we serve others. So this morning, what I want us to do in John chapter 4 is look at four questions. There are four questions that I think she actually is asking, like three of them with explicit questions. And then the last one is, I think, an implied question, but she states it in an unusual way. So here are the four questions, the way I'm framing them to make them a bit more practical for us in our own context. And then we'll tie it into what she's saying here in the chapter. First of all, the first question, why do you care about me? Why do you care about me? Is the first question she asked Jesus. Secondly, the second question, are you greater? Now, the way I'm saying this is, are you greater than my tribe? Because this notion of tribalism is very dominant in the Bible. They group together very strong and then fight each other literally. And we're living in a cultural context where certain groups of unity across tribes are breaking down, and we're falling down into a tribal mentality of an us against them. And so the second question is actually, are you greater than my tribe? Are you greater than what I have found my identity in that level? The third question is, well, where should I stake my whole life then? Because he's moving her in a direction towards him. And then the final question is, whom should I really trust? So let's work through John chapter 4 and see these questions and how they unfold. Because each question brings the woman closer to Jesus. And that's why I say one of the key aspects of this is drawing near to Jesus. Jesus is so patient. I just am astounded in my own personal experience. I mean, I could think through my life and give you a few stories about when I felt like Jesus really encountered me in important moments in my life in a transition. Some of those moments I recognized when they were happening. It was like a light came on and I felt a move of God's Spirit or something like that. Many of them I didn't recognize till after it was over. And I looked back and I thought, he was there. And so that's what we're going to see as Jesus draws this woman who's isolated and lost and confused. He draws her very patiently to himself. Question number one that she asks, why would you care about me? I get this from chapter 4, verse 9. The question she actually says is, how is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? Now, the reason why I say, why would you care about me, is that John clues us in about what's going on, about informing us about the hostilities between Jews and Samaritans at the very end of verse 9, and my study Bible has a parenthesis, for Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. The Samaritans were left over from the northern Jewish kingdom that had intermarried. And so the hostility, the racial tension between these two groups was really intense. And they had no dealings with each other. They did not want anything to do with each other. And to her surprise, Jesus actually engages her. He asks her for a drink. He's talking to her. He's taking the moment to actually interact with her. When probably, if you've studied this, you know she's coming to the well at the middle of the day. The sixth hour is noonish. And so she's avoiding the crowd. How often is it the case that someone just avoids the group because they have so much weight on their life of sin and pain and struggle? And so they just go by themselves to the well. And there sits this man who's a Jew. Could you imagine what was going through this woman's mind? Oh, gosh. Here we go again. I'm going to get mistreated. Who knows? She goes on, and he asks her for a drink. And she says, how is it that you ask me for a drink? Now, what's fascinating in verse 10 is Jesus absolutely ignores her question, which he tends to do because we ask the wrong questions. If you knew the gift of God, verse 10, and who it is that is saying to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. Now, could you imagine the surprise of this woman that this man is still talking to her, but now he's no longer asking for her to give him a physical drink? He shifted the conversation to something with this living water. So the first question is, that I said was, why do you care about me, is that he has now not only engaged her in a conversation, he's continuing the conversation, and he's actually offering her something. He's offering her something that he's calling living water. Now, we know at the beginning she doesn't get it because she's still thinking in very horizontal physical terms, and not upward. So that brings her to the second question that I said was really the question, are you greater than my tribe? Notice in verse 12. Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us this well and drank from it himself, and as did his sons and his livestock. So the second question that I said, are you greater than my tribe? They are identifying all the way back to Jacob and claiming Jacob as their descendant and that he established this well. And she's saying, are you greater than the one that established my tribe, my people, the one we look to? Are you greater than this founder for us? And as we read, I think as we read this question, I do think we detect a sense of sarcasm in her words. She tells Jesus that, you know, are you greater than Jacob, our father? I think it's a rhetorical question, really. I think she's expecting him to say, no, I'm not greater than Jacob. Don't misunderstand this. We all appeal to Jacob. But she has actually ran into someone who is greater than Jacob. And so she's moved past the notion that this guy's just a typical Jew who's not honoring her or loving her or caring for her, who might have mistreated her. And so now she's moving in to try to figure out what exactly is going on here. Now notice how Jesus answers her in verse 13. Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. Now, Jesus indirectly answers her question, right? Because she said, are you greater than our father Jacob who gave us this water? So without saying, yes, I am, I have something different, he says, if you drink Jacob's water, you'll thirst again. Your fundamental problem, if you can get on track with me, Jesus is saying, is that you keep going back to something that will never satisfy you. And so what you have to do is come to me, and I will give you the water that springs up to eternal life. Now, here we reach a very interesting turn in our story. That this man sitting here in front of this woman is actually saying the opposite of what she expected. He's actually saying, yes, I am greater than Jacob. And so she's going to challenge him a little bit in verse 15. Give me this water so I don't have to be thirsty and come here and draw again. Now, let's pause for a moment and consider what she's saying. She's actually still stuck on the water in the well and getting a physical cup and drinking it. And she's like, okay, if you're greater than Jacob, give me the water. How do I get this water? Jesus is trying to shift her to the spiritual dynamic of living water that satisfies your soul better than anything else. And so she's not making this turn. So what do you do to help her make this turn? Well, you look into her life and you find the place where she goes for water is what you do. So to put it a different way, for us, Jesus looks into your life and finds out, where do you really go for your water? Where do you find your source of joy that doesn't last? Where do you find that moment of satisfaction that when it's past doesn't leave you feeling the way you thought it would leave you feeling? And so Jesus says to her in verse 16, go call your husband and come back here. Ouch. Go call your husband and come back. Let's see where you're finding the source of water. She says, I don't have a husband. And Jesus says, you are right in saying I have no husband. For you have had five, and the one you are with now is not your husband. So what you have said is true. Now this shift in the conversation baffles people. There's all kinds of views, differing views about what's happening. Some people think that she's trying to distract Jesus and change the topic of the conversation. I think that's actually what John Piper thinks. She's trying to run away because he's confronted her with her sin. I do think that she says, I have no husband, because she's scared. And she's like, uh-oh, why did he go there? Like, could you imagine? I know we're reading it as a story in the Bible, but put yourself as that woman with that history, sitting at a well with a male in that time of a group who's hostile against you, and what are you thinking? I'm in serious trouble. I'm about to be mistreated again, abused, whatever she's thinking. And this man is now talking about this living water and has called her out on her husband's. So she actually says, and this is where I get this third question. She actually says, verse 19, the woman said to him, sir, I perceive you're a prophet. Now, let me pause here before I get to the question, because this is important for how I see this unfolding. She starts out thinking of him as just another Jew sitting there, and he's not. He challenged Jacob. She said, are you greater than Jacob? And he says, yes, implied, but he says, yes, I am. I have something that you can't get anywhere else, living water. And now what she says in verse 19 shows that she's actually tracking. I perceive you're a prophet. That's an acknowledgement that he's greater than Jacob. That's acknowledgement that there's something different going on here. This man sees into my life and is still talking to me and has not ran away or taken advantage of me. And so then she asked him a question in verse 20. And this is where some people say she's trying to distract Jesus and get away from the topic. Verse 20, our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. Now, it does seem that she throws out a religious controversy, a theological controversy, and it might be, okay, let's stop this conversation. But I don't see it that way. She just said she perceives it as a prophet. I think verse 20 is really a question about, where should I stake my life? Where should I worship? What should I do if you're that prophet? Because everybody's saying something different. That group, this group, that group. So where do I worship? Where do I stake what you're talking about? So Jesus says to her in verse 21, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. Now look at how Jesus answered her. He did not go back to what she didn't answer. The husbands, what's she doing? He didn't go back to her sin the way we often do. We Presbyterians sometimes get so wrapped up around sin that even when we move past it, we don't. We go back to it and beat people up. Let the work of grace do its work. Watch what Jesus does here. He lets that go, and he comes back to her after her asking about worship, and he realizes, because Jesus' goal here is not just to deal with that sin, it's to get living water to her. Because if he can get that to her, he solves the other issue. So he says, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. Now pause and think about what he's saying here. We can read past that because we're sitting in a nice building in Jackson, Tennessee. People who have gathered to worship Jesus, and we think, yeah, this is what we do. We gather and worship. But if you were a Jew, if you were one of those 12 disciples that walked away from Jesus, and you walked back up and heard Jesus say what he says in this verse, that neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father, what would you say? You would say, are you kidding me? We're always going to worship on that mountain in Jerusalem. That's where worship happens. But Jesus says there's coming a day when it's not going to matter whether it's in Jerusalem or on this mountain like you claim. So he's not even he's saying something bigger than what the Jews are saying. He says, verse 23, the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him. It's amazing. He offers it right there to her, saying that this whole thing that's been going on for so many years is about to transform. It's here now. And he says, verse 24, God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. it's astounding to me the cataclysmic change he's describing in this verse when you have that temple sitting on that mountain that he says in John that when you tear it down, I'll rebuild it. And John says, you remember, right? John says, he's talking about himself. So he tells this woman, just consider, I think it's astounding that of all the people that find something out so fundamental about worship in this gospel, it's this Samaritan woman that hears it. So now look what she says. And this is where I get the fourth question. That the fourth question is really, who then should I really trust? Well, there's no way someone sits there and hears what he just says that doesn't realize he is turning this whole thing upside down. He's not just a typical Jew. He's not just greater than our father Jacob. And he's not just a prophet. He's something else. So notice what she says next, and let's see if you think that I might be right in following what she's doing. Verse 25, the woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming. He is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us these things. Now just think about what it took for her to say that. I think she inserts Messiah coming here because there's one person in the history of the Old Testament, prophetic language, that can come and do what was described in this passage. There's one person that can reorient salvation. There's one person that can shift worship so that worship is no longer just stuck here in this local place, but it transcends the globe, according to passages all through the Old Testament. That one person is the Messiah. And she actually says, I know when he comes, he'll tell us these things. Well, what did Jesus just do for her? He just told her these things. So it's a very unique dance between questions that are not explicit questions. She can't just bring herself to say, are you really the Messiah? And risk the embarrassment of him going, are you kidding me? So she implies it. But look at what Jesus says there in verse 26. And this language from Jesus is even stronger than the way our English Bibles say, because he uses, my ESV says, Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. It's actually, I am. He actually uses the expression, I am. And then he says in Greek or whatever he was speaking to her, maybe Hebrew or whatever, I am, and I am the one speaking to you. It's a combination of being able to communicate, I'm speaking to you, but he uses the I am. And some of you are tracking with this because what he's doing is he's using the great expression in Exodus of Yahweh. I am who I am. And he lays it right there in front of her. To a woman that no one cared for. To a woman that was looking for water everywhere else. And he says, you'll find it right here, this living water. And so the way I think this unfolds is he's not just a typical Jew. He's not just greater than Jacob. He's not just another prophet. He is the Messiah, the anointed one. And now, look what, and to tie in what's happening here with this notion of water, you remember the passage in Jeremiah 2 that we read, right? God's offended at his people, and he says they've committed two evils. Remember what the two evils were? You've forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and you have made for yourselves cisterns, broken cisterns that hold no water. The most condemning thing that the prophet said, the people of God who are supposed to come to the one true God and receive their living water from him, turned away from him, and they have forsaken him, the fountain of living water. And what they've done is they have made themselves cisterns. Now, a cistern can be, in that language, a couple of things. It's certainly like a primitive well that goes down deep in the ground. A cistern can also be a description of the clay pot, because the well has this clay, it's like a big clay pot in the ground. So it also is like a clay pot you carry water in. And so your cistern, he's saying two things by this cistern in Jeremiah 2. The well is broken and leaking and you don't have water, but you also, it could be applied to your pot is broken and it doesn't hold water. And I tell you what, in America, we have perfected cistern making. We've painted them and dressed them up and we parade them around and say, look how great this is. And we go to sleep at night knowing that it's leaking water. And we're not really finding what we need there. And the only place to find what we need is with Jesus. And so God says, you've forsaken me, the fountain of living water, and now you've made yourself cisterns, wells, and clay pots that hold no water, and you're not finding the source of eternal life. And so what does this woman do at the very end? This is one of the most, this may be one of my favorite stories in the New Testament as it unfolds, if I'm right in the way I'm reading it. But I certainly, this last piece of evidence is just the icing on the cake. would that it would be, and I think it is, it actually is true that this is how it should work. The disciples come back, verse 27, they marveled that he was talking with this woman, but nobody said, what are you doing? Why are you talking to her? And then notice what verse 28 says. I'll let you look at it first. What'd she leave behind? Her water pot. She leaves behind the little clay cistern that represented not just getting that water, but her life. Going to that well at the middle of the day. The places where she tried to find all the peace and happiness, the joy. She leaves that water pot behind and she goes back into the town and look what she says in verse 29. Come see a man that told me all I ever did. That's the gospel. He's a man that knows everything you've ever done. The darkest secrets you've never told anyone, he knows. And he offers to you still living water. So leave your pot behind. Let go of that broken clay pot that's not working. And listen to the words that Jesus gives at the very end of Revelation. Come, let him who is thirsty come. Let him who desires to take the water of life without price come. That's what Jesus offers you. And that's why we call this the gospel. That's really good news.